The Principles of Economics, Lecture 12. Why the Government Intervenes in Our Markets and Lives. The Economist's Critique.
Hi, I'm Peter Navarro, and welcome to Lecture 12. In this lecture, we are going to focus on both how and why the government intervenes in the private marketplace. Such government intervention into what many of us like to believe is a free market has an enormous effect on our everyday lives. As an employer or worker in a private corporation, the government imposes a wide range of health, safety, and environmental regulations at the same time that it takes a large tax bite out of your profits or wages. When you visit a restaurant or butcher shop, the government is there to prevent food poisoning through meat inspections. And as you jump into your car or onto your motorcycle, that seatbelt or helmet you must wear has been mandated by the government as well. In fact, from cradle to grave, the government always seems to be with us, whether it is providing police protection or a national defense system or roads and bridges and clean air. The question is why, particularly in a country such as America, which wraps itself in the flag of unbridled capitalism and the free market. Why do we see so much regulation and government intervention? And is it a bad thing, or perhaps in certain economic circumstances, a good thing for society? To start off, I want to revisit some of the terrain from lectures 10 and 11. In those lectures, we introduced the market structure of perfect competition, and more importantly, we said that when all of the assumptions of perfect competition are met, then the invisible hand of the private marketplace delivers the most efficient economic outcome, just as Adam Smith predicted. But we also said that when one or more of the assumptions of perfect competition are not met, then we have what's called a market failure. And in the presence of such market failures, many economists will prescribe some type of regulatory response or other government intervention. In fact, we have already talked about one such response with monopoly. With a monopoly, the assumption of numerous buyers and sellers is not met. The monopolist is able to drive up the price in the market because of his or her market power, and government intervention in the form of price or rate regulation will often occur, just as we see in monopolistic industries like electricity and natural gas distribution. And in this same vein, and more broadly, a nation's whole latticework of various so-called antitrust regulations are likewise regulatory responses to imperfect competition in the form of oligopoly where, as we have also learned, problems of both explicit and tacit collusion may arise. So, antitrust regulators will impose restrictions on things like business mergers to prevent the concentration of market power and simply ban outright all forms of explicit collusion. Now let's turn to three other very important types of market failures and come to understand the role of government in correcting these failures. These failures include the public goods problem, which will help us better understand everything from police protection to lighthouses, the externalities market failure, that will help us understand things like environmental regulations, public education, and free vaccines. And finally, the problem of asymmetric information, which will explain why we put labels and disclosures on products ranging from soup cans and wine bottles to mortgage documents. Let's start then with the public goods problem, and let's put it into its proper perspective with these statistics. Each year, the United States government spends close to $500 billion on one public good alone, national defense. And these defense expenditures represent a full 15% of the total federal budget. At the same time, billions more are spent on other so-called public goods, ranging from parks, roads, and bridges, to our criminal justice system, flood control programs, and even our lighthouses on the high seas. So why is it that the government, rather than the private marketplace, has to provide for all these public goods? The answer lies in understanding the nature of the public goods market failure. To start towards that answer, let's first contrast private versus public goods. Private goods like hot dogs and shotguns and flashlights are divisible. What I mean by that is that they come in small enough units to be afforded by individual buyers. Importantly, a private good is also rival in consumption. In other words, if I consume the good, you can't. Finally, a private good is subject to the exclusion principle. Those unable or unwilling to pay can be excluded from the product's benefits. In contrast, public goods, like national defense or lighthouses, have several characteristics that make them quite different from shotguns and flashlights. For starters, public goods are indivisible. This is because they come in such large units that individual buyers cannot afford them. But public goods are also non-rival in consumption. Both you and I can consume a public good without interfering with the other's enjoyment. Perhaps most importantly of all, exclusion from the consumption of a public good is very difficult, and with some goods, even impossible. And as we shall soon see, this non-excludability makes it very difficult for the private marketplace to supply the good. Okay, so far, that's all pretty abstract. So now, let me be more specific. Suppose you are holding a hot dog in your hand. And further suppose that I tell you that I'm really hungry and I want your hot dog. But you're hungry too, so that if I eat that hot dog, you can't. In other words, that hot dog is rival in consumption. Now contrast this hot dog situation with that of national defense. Here, you are standing on American soil, perhaps, protected by an army, a navy, an air force, and a deadly array of nuclear missiles. But guess what? I am protected as well. More importantly, my protection by this defense umbrella does not interfere with your protection. In other words, the defense umbrella is non-rival in consumption. And one of the reasons is that public goods, like national defense, are indivisible and too large to be purchased by one individual. Now here's the problem we face when we try to rely on the free market to provide public goods like national defense. Nobody wants to pay for public goods. The reason has to do with the third characteristic of a public good, non-excludability. In fact, once the public good is provided, a producer cannot possibly exclude non-payers from receiving its indivisible benefits. This creates a perverse incentive among potential buyers to want to free ride. And by the way, this concept of the free rider ranks right up there among the top 10 most important concepts in all of economics. When the free rider problem is present, potential buyers will not want to pay for a good precisely because they can obtain that benefit for free. And perhaps as important, these free riders will not even want to reveal their true preferences as to how much they value the good. Why do you think this might be so? Well, if the government were to know how much each person might be willing to pay for the provision of a public good, that's how much the government would probably tax them. So free riders don't really want to reveal that information. Of course, the result of this free rider problem is that the perceived demand for the public good doesn't generate enough revenue to cover the cost of production. And I want to quickly add here that this is so even though the collective benefits of the public good may well exceed the economic costs. Now, let's illustrate this free rider problem with the case of flood control in a beautiful but flood-plagued valley. No one in this valley wants to be flooded out. But each landowner knows that a flood control program will protect all landowners regardless of who pays. This is because either the entire valley is protected or no one is. Accordingly, individual farmers and landowners may say they don't really want a dam and aren't willing to pay for it, but all the while, what they are really doing is waiting and hoping that someone else will step in and pay for the flood control. In other words, everyone wants a free ride. And if we leave this project to market forces, no one will demand flood control, and all the property in the valley will sooner or later be washed away. So here's our first punchline. The economic difference between public goods and private goods rests on technical consideration, not political philosophy. The central question is whether we have the technical capability to exclude non-payers from non-rival goods like national defense or flood control. And it's not just that we must have the technical capability, it's also that exclusion must be economically feasible. Take the case of city streets. In theory, we could restrict the use of such streets to only those who pay to use them. We could do this by putting a gate on every corner. But of course, that would be exceedingly expensive and impractical to do so. So, city streets have the characteristics of a public good. And to our list of public goods, we can also add the administration of justice, the regulation of commerce, the conduct of foreign relations, and the provision of certain types of goods, such as lighthouses, bridges, and roads. Now that we've made the case that the private marketplace won't provide public goods or will undersupply them, our next question is this. How do we ensure that the government provides an economically efficient supply of a public good? In real-world terms, how do we as a society decide how much national defense and flood control is optimal? And how many lighthouses and parks should our government provide? Well, one of the most useful economic tools to answer these types of questions involves something that you have probably heard quite a bit about, cost-benefit analysis. This form of analysis provides the government with a way of quite literally comparing the cost of a project, like that of a lighthouse or a bridge or a new highway, to the benefits of the project. Consider, for example, the aforementioned flood control project that nobody wanted to pay for. Well, the government might come in and see if the economics of the project might justify the government building the project. On the benefit side of the cost-benefit equation, the benefits of such a project will come from the reduction in damage to the land in the valley in the event of a flood. The cost of such a project is the loss of satisfaction associated with the accompanying decline in the production of private goods or some other public good. And note that this cost can usually be measured simply by the cost of building the project. Now, our benefit-cost decision rule is simply this. If the benefits from the project exceed its costs, we should build the project. However, if the costs exceed the benefits, we should not. Let's turn now to our second major market failure, that of so-called externalities. The idea behind externalities is that the production or consumption of a good may generate spillover effects, that is, external benefits or costs that are not accurately reflected in the supply and demand curves of producers and consumers. As a result of these spillover effects or externalities, the free market may be inefficient and undersupply or oversupply the good. For example, suppose your company makes computer chips in Silicon Valley. In order to make those chips, you must pay your workers, invest in new plant equipment, and buy your raw materials. Of course, each of these costs will be reflected in your private marginal cost curve, which, you may recall from a previous lecture, is also your firm's supply curve. But further assume that in producing your computer chips, your company also generates large amounts of toxic waste. In a free market, and in the absence of any laws to the contrary, your company might simply dump these toxic wastes into a nearby river to minimize its costs. Nonetheless, the resulting pollution will not be without cost to the broader society. Children may get leukemia from drinking water from the river. Fishermen may catch less fish because the toxic waste kill the fish, and homeowners along the river may get sick from the smell. These types of external or spillover effects are called negative externalities, and because they will not be borne by your firm in a free market, they are not reflected in your supply curve. The likely result is that your firm will produce both too many computer chips and too much pollution from society's point of view. Note, however, that externalities are not always bad. In fact, positive externalities arise when all of the benefits of consuming a good do not accrue to the individual consumer. To understand this concept, suppose Sherlock Holmes is concerned about getting the flu and decides to go for a flu shot to his private physician, Dr. Watson. By getting this shot, the good detective Holmes not only protects himself from getting the flu, He also helps protect the broader London population from catching the flu from him. Thus, when we magnify Holmes' behavior to the entire population, vaccinations mean a healthier and more productive workforce, a larger national output, and higher incomes for society. The problem, however, is that the free market tends to lead to the underconsumption of goods that yield positive externalities, from vaccinations to education. The broader point here is that the externalities problem provides a strong economic rationale for a good portion of federal, state, and local intervention into the free market on issues ranging from environmental protection and traffic congestion to education and public health. This is because in the case of negative externalities like pollution and congestion, the free market is likely to produce too much of the externality and too much of the good generating the externality. In contrast, with a positive externality, the market undersupplies the good and generates too few spillover effects. Our next question logically, then, is a public policy one. Should the government intervene in the private marketplace to somehow correct such externalities? And if so, what form should such intervention take? Before we jump to the conclusion that the answer must always be yes, I want to introduce you to a very important theory in economics called the Coase theorem. It helps to illustrate that, at least in some situations, government intervention into the marketplace may not be necessary because externalities can be solved through individual bargaining. The Coase theorem was conceived by University of Chicago professor and Nobel laureate Ronald Coase. Coase argued that negative or positive externalities do not require government intervention where, 1, property ownership is clearly defined, 2, the number of people involved is small, and 3, bargaining costs are negligible. Here's an example of how the Coase theorem might actually work. Suppose you live in a small town with 100 other people, and suppose I own a tannery in that town that, in addition to producing leather, also stinks to high heaven. Suppose further that I make a lot of money from that tannery, but you and your neighbors suffer a lot from the stench. In thinking about how we might resolve this problem between us, let's first assign the property rights to the air to me, meaning that under the current law, I have a perfect right to pollute as much of the air as I want. How might Coase-type bargaining between your group and me resolve this issue? Well, the Coase theorem predicts that your group might offer to pay me to reduce my output, or alternatively, simply buy my tannery and shut it down. As for how much your group will pay me, that amount will depend on how much profits my plant generates, how much your group values eliminating the discomfort caused by my plant, and how well each side negotiates. And if the value your group assigns to eliminating your discomfort is more than my profits, we may well come to some bargain. Now let's switch property rights. Let's say that your group owns the rights to the air, and the only way I can produce my leather is to purchase from you the right to pollute. What will the Coase theorem predict here? In this case, I will have to pay your group at least as much as the value your group puts on having clean air. If my profits are high enough to afford that, I will presumably do so. But if not, I will simply have to close my plant. Now, one thing that is very interesting about this example is that who has to pay who to reduce or eliminate the externality is completely determined by the initial assigning of property rights. If I have the rights, your group pays me, and vice versa. Now, in your view, who, in this example, should be assigned the property rights to the air? Your group in town, or me and my tannery? Well, if you are like most people, you probably said that the people in town should own the rights to clean air as a matter of fairness. But suppose I told you that my factory was there first, and that your group only recently moved into town. Would this make a difference? Now, the other interesting question about this example is how might the Coase theorem break down? Well, in the case where the town has to pay me not to pollute, there has to be some mechanism to collect the money from the townspeople. In reality, this might be rather difficult. For example, some people might be bothered more than others by the stench, and some may not be bothered at all. Should everyone pay the same amount? Should only those who are bothered pay? And recalling our old friend, the free rider problem that plagues the provision of public goods, how can we tell if people are telling the truth about how much the stench bothers them, particularly if their payment will depend on that answer? Now, from these questions, you can see that as the number of people involved in the negotiations increases, the Coase theorem tends to break down. A case in point is the acid rain problem in the United States and Canada, which affects millions of people spread out over two nations. The vast number of affected parties could not possibly independently negotiate an agreement or remedy this problem. Instead, we must rely on both governments to find acceptable solutions. The broader point is that while the Coase theorem reminds us that clearly defined property rights can be a positive factor in remedying externalities, many negative externalities involve large numbers of affected people, high bargaining costs, and community property such as air and water. Thus, in these cases, it may be appropriate for the government to intervene. Now let's talk about a second approach to internalizing externalities, which likewise has some limited applicability. This second approach relies upon a legal framework of liability laws known as the wrongful act or tort system. The idea behind torts is that the person or corporation that produces the negative externality is legally liable for any damages caused to other persons. For example, suppose the Ajax Degreaser Company regularly dumps leaky barrels of solvents into a nearby canyon owned by the Barbecue Ranch. But the Barbecue Ranch discovers this dump site and traces the leaky barrels to Ajax. Under the tort system, Ajax will get sued, and if Ajax loses, it will not only have to pay the Barbecue Ranch for the cleanup, it may well have to pay additional damages for despoiling ranch property. Note, however, that as with the Coase theorem, this tort system has its own limitations. For one thing, lawsuits are expensive, time-consuming, and have uncertain outcomes, while major time delays in the court system are commonplace. In addition, there is great uncertainty. Will the court or a jury accept your claim that your child's leukemia has resulted from the toxic waste emitted by the degreaser plant next door? Can you prove that a specific firm in the area is the source of the contamination of your own well? And are you, as an individual, willing to risk all the money in your bank account to sue a large, deep-pocketed corporation with hundreds of millions of dollars in assets and a team of 50 lawyers? But these obstacles notwithstanding, there is an even larger problem with the tort system. Many negative externalities do not involve private property, but rather property held in common. Indeed, it is the public bodies of water, public lands, and the public air that often bear the brunt of negative externalities. This observation leads us to our third approach to internalizing externalities, direct government intervention. Direct government intervention into the free market involves placing limits on the amount of pollution a polluter may emit. In fact, this command and control approach has dominated environmental public policy in the United States for decades. For example, the Clean Air Act limits the amounts of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, particulates, and other substances that power plants and factories may emit into the air. Similarly, the Clean Water Act specifies the amount of heavy metals, detergents, and other pollutants that firms can dump into rivers and bays. Violation of these laws means fines and, on occasion, imprisonment. Note, however, there is a second way that this same command and control result can be achieved, and it is a method that many economists prefer, both because it is less intrusive into the marketplace and also because it relies more upon market and pricing signals. This method involves the use of so-called Pigouvian taxes and subsidies to tax negative externalities and subsidize positive externalities. And if you're wondering where the word Pigouvian comes from, it is used in honor of the French economist A.C. Pigou, who originally thought up the idea. In fact, Pigouvian-like taxes are regularly used by the government to internalize externalities. For example, the federal government has placed an excise tax on the manufacturers of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, which deplete the stratospheric ozone layer protecting the Earth from excessive solar ultraviolet radiation. This substance is used widely as a coolant in refrigeration, a blowing agent for foam, and a solvent for electronics. Facing such a tax, manufacturers must decide whether to pay it or expend additional funds to purchase or develop substitute products. In either case, the tax will increase the marginal costs of producing CFCs. This shifts the private supply curve for the product inward and presumably closer towards the optimal level. Pigouvian subsidies can likewise be used to internalize positive externalities. For example, the government might give each new mother a discount coupon to spend on a polio vaccination for her child. Alternatively, the government might provide a subsidy to physicians and medical clinics to supply more of the vaccine at a cheaper price. Finally, let me note here that when the spillover benefits of providing something like a vaccine are extremely large, the government may decide to directly provide the product as a public good as an alternative to subsidization. In fact, the U.S. government has largely eradicated the crippling disease of polio by administering free vaccines to all children. India similarly ended smallpox by paying people in rural areas to come to public clinics to have their children vaccinated. Now, to end this lecture, I want to touch very briefly on the third type of market failure that often requires government intervention. This is that of so-called asymmetric information. This kind of problem can arise particularly when buyers don't have complete information about a product. Consider, for example, a diabetic or an alcoholic. There are a lot of quite healthy-sounding foods, like canned corn or orange juice, that contain added sugar, while a lot of medical products like mouthwash and cough syrup can also contain alcohol. For a diabetic to accidentally ingest added sugar, the results can be dangerous. Similarly, an unwanted exposure to alcohol can kick off an alcoholic binge. And in alcoholic beverages like wine, there are even a lot of ingredients like albumin, for example, that can cause serious allergic reactions in people who would really like to know if such an ingredient is present. For these kinds of reasons, the government often requires labeling and disclosure laws. More broadly, there are two other types of situations where problems associated with asymmetric information can arise. One is called adverse selection. The other is known as moral hazard. In the case of adverse selection, the problem actually begins before the transaction occurs. Consider the case of a bank trying to sort out bad credit risks. As it often turns out, it is precisely those individuals with such bad credit that are most likely to actively seek out a loan, and thus a bank might select too many of these risky individuals. The result will be a higher incidence of default. And because in a free market for credit, banks can't identify these people beforehand, they must charge higher interest rates to everyone. Of course, one market-based solution is to develop credit scoring systems that banks can use. The other type of asymmetric information problem, moral hazard, doesn't arise until after the transaction is consummated. Such moral hazard refers to the risks that arise when the signing of a contract might change the behavior of one of the signers. The classic example of moral hazard involves the insurance industry. Somebody goes out and gets some coverage against a loss, say a stolen or a wrecked car, and then because the person is covered by insurance, he or she is less careful about locking up the car and more adventurous when driving it. In such cases, one market-based solution to the problem of moral hazard is to increase the so-called copay that somebody might sustain in the event of a loss. The broader point here is that this whole area of asymmetric information is a fascinating one in the field of economics. And while I've just scratched the surface here, at least you have some idea of how informational problems can affect markets. and better motivate the government to get involved in a solution. Well, that concludes Lecture 11. Please do remember to complete the exercises in your study guide before moving on to the next lecture. In the meantime, I'm Peter Navarro from the University of California, Irvine.
After listening to Lecture 12, a student posed this question to Professor Navarro. Why does the government require motorcycle riders to wear helmets in some states? Let's listen to the professor's response.
The mandatory helmet law can be interpreted as a solution to a negative externality problem. The problem here is that when motorcycle riders are out there on the freeway riding without helmets and they get into accidents, there's a much greater chance that they will be hurt seriously. And when that happens and they're sent to the hospital, they may not have adequate insurance to pay for all of their care. Who pays for it then? Well, it's the state and the government. So, to avoid those kind of external costs, the government may require motorcycle helmets in some states.
Another student then asked, cigarettes are taxed heavily by the government, and smoking is banned in many public places. Is this a moral judgment against smoking?
Some anti-smoking advocates may have moral problems with cigarettes, and that might justify their actions. But I think the larger issue here really is an economic one. People who smoke statistically just have a lot more health problems, and those health problems wind up costing society in terms of not only health care, but in lower productivity because they tend to miss more work days in the workplace. So the idea here really is to make sure that smoking doesn't proliferate in public places. And the taxing issue is kind of interesting because these sin taxes, as we learned in a previous lecture, are characterized by goods like cigarettes and tobacco, which haven't high any elasticity of demand, so it's easier for the government to get revenues out of taxing things like cigarettes and alcohol. So essentially they're killing two birds with one stone on an economic basis. You get more revenues because of the inelasticity of demand, plus you help internalize a negative externality.
Finally, a student asked, how come I can't get detailed map information about where different cell phone companies have the best coverage in their network so I can make a more informed decision?
This is a great example of how the economics of asymmetric information meet the economics of oligopoly power. In this particular case, there are only a few large cell phone companies, and they really don't want to give you that information because they fear that if you really know that information, you might not use their coverage. So collectively, these companies have colluded to make sure that no regulations are imposed upon them, even though there's a strong economic argument for doing so, that the choices everybody would make would be better choices.
This ends Lecture 12.